Lecture 48, Beyond the Classical, the Greeks and Us.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Greek history would never be the same again after Alexander. The days of individual polis exerting influence over others were over. The days of conflict between different polis were also over. And there was now only one Greek empire, the Macedonian. Under the Macedonian hegemony that Philip had established in 337, and which Alexander re-established after the abortive Greek revolt in 336, the Greeks lost their autonomy. And in 322, Athens lost its radical democracy for good. But at the same time, Macedonian rule provided the Greeks with a period of peace that brought prosperity after the civil strife that had characterized the archaic and classical periods. It's not just Greek history that would never be the same again. So too, the Greeks' position or role in the Mediterranean world would differ forever. Thanks to the empire that Alexander the Great forged from Greece in the west to India in the east, the Greeks came into contact with a much larger world. They took advantage of new trading routes and new economic ventures. And during the Hellenistic period, those who lived in the Mediterranean basin as a whole came to develop a sense of belonging to that larger world. In this, our final lecture, I want to talk broadly about changes in Greece during the 400 years or so from the start of the Archaic period to the end of the Classical period, and what these changes mean for us. I want to begin with a sort of historical epilogue to the periods that we've been studying in our course. What happened in Greece, and especially Athens, after the Classical period, and why? Then I want to discuss what advances the Greeks made from the end of the Dark Ages to the Classical period, and whether, by comparison, future societies made similar developments. This will take us into a consideration of what we have learned from Greek civilization, or not learned from it, and whether we could have learned more. But here, I'd like to say a few personal words, if I may. This is our last lecture, and I feel a sense of sadness as I give it. I'm very grateful indeed that you chose this course, and that you allowed me into your lives to talk about a period and a civilization that I love to teach, that I love to learn more about through research, and even add to existing knowledge when I can. Thank you very much indeed. And I would love to hear from you, as I've said before, with your comments about the course, responding to questions that we've raised during the lectures, or even responding to the heresies that I've been running past you in also in so many lectures. So please do drop me a line. But now back to more serious things, back to business. How and why did Athens decline as a political and military power in the Hellenistic period? The answer is threefold. First, Greece as a whole became a battlefield among Alexander's successors as they fought for the Macedonian throne. Second, Macedonian control of Athens meant the abolition of its democracy and the installation of a garrison in the city. And third and final, the Athenians were never able to bounce back, as they had done after the end of the Peloponnesian War, for example. They were never in a position to lead Greece again. Now let's look at these three factors in some detail. After Alexander the Great died in June 323, the period known as the Hellenistic Age began. This stretched down past the Romans' annexation of Greece into their empire in 146 to the Battle of Actium, when Octavian defeated Antony and Cleopatra in 31 BC. Before Rome arrived on the scene, the Greeks continued to be dominated by the kings of Macedonia. For the first half century or so after Alexander's death in 323, Greece was a battleground in the wars of his successors as they vied for the Macedonian throne. They wanted also to win Greece, and to this end, they saw that control of Athens would give them control of Greece. Their attitude flowed directly from the power that Athens had wielded during its 5th and 4th century empires, when it was the most prominent of the Greek states of the mainland, as we've seen. Now, when Antipater, Alexander's regent of Greece, died in 319, Athens was able to restore some semblance of its democracy. Antipater had abolished Athenian democracy in 322 at the end of the Lamian War, as we mentioned in the last lecture. But this restoration of democracy was very short-lived. Antipater's son Cassander sought power in Macedonia for himself, and in the process he came to clash with a rival called Polyperchon. Now, anxious to weaken Polyperchon's grip over Macedonia, Cassander decided to seize Greece, and to this end he besieged Athens in 317. It soon fell to him, and Cassander installed in the city a puppet ruler, Demetrius of Phalerum, who was supported by another Macedonian garrison. Now, Demetrius of Phalerum ruled Athens absolutely for the next 10 years. But at least for the first time in decades, Athens enjoyed a period of stability. Demetrius was an educated man. He allowed philosophy to flourish, and he was a friend of the new comedy playwright Menander. In this period also, Theophrastus became the head of Aristotle's school, the Lyceum, and Athens acquired the reputation as a philosophical centre that it held throughout the Hellenistic period. Demetrius also held the first census in Greece in the year 307. Now, the Athenian citizen body, that's adult male citizens, numbered 21,000, and the number of resident aliens about 10,000 in 307. Add to these figures wives and children, and we have a population of perhaps 100,000 or so. Now, population figures before then are completely unknown, but we might not be too far off the mark if we think of the population of classical Athens as perhaps double that of Hellenistic, about 200,000. Because in abolishing democracy in 319, Antipater also introduced a property requirement for citizenship, and as a result, a large number of Athenian citizens lost their citizenship, and some left Athens to live elsewhere. So we have to bring the numbers down anyway in the Hellenistic period from what they were in the classical. Demetrius of Phalerum's rule came to an end in 307 when he was expelled, along with the Macedonian garrison, by Alexander's now aging general Antigonus Monophthalmos and his son Demetrius Polyoketes. What some fantastic names! Monophthalmos means single eye, by the way, so obviously he had only one eye. Polyoketes means the besieger. It was a nickname that Demetrius Polyoketes, the son, got when he besieged the island of Rhodes. Now, Antigonus Monophthalmos and Demetrius Polyoketes were intent on taking Macedonia and Greece from Cassander. In order to appease themselves to the Athenians, they allowed the democracy to be restored, and a grateful citizen body recognized these two as savior gods. Now, this move backfired on the Athenians because Polyoketes decided to move into the Parthenon, the temple to the city's deity, Athena. And he turned the Parthenon into a brothel. Now, when the horrified Athenians protested about this, he told them that he could do what he wanted, as they'd made him a god and the temple was his sister's house after all, and she probably wouldn't mind. The death of Antigonus Monophthalmos in battle in Asia, and the flight of Polycrates from that same battle in 301, the Battle of Ipsus, gave Cassander Athens again. He probably installed some type of military oligarchy in the city. But in 297, Cassander died. And in 296, Polycrates was able to retake Athens. See, it's not really complicated, is it? Now, this time, Polycrates was careful to install his own garrison to keep the Athenians in check, while he travelled north to take over the Macedonian throne. But that was not to be. With the help of Ptolemy I of Egypt, and Ptolemy was another of Alexander's generals, in 287, the Athenians were able to revolt from Polycrates, to storm the garrison. They didn't expel it, but they stormed it, and they forced Polycrates to come to terms with them, which included a restoration of their democracy. Unfortunately, Polycrates' son, Antigonus Gonatas — Gonatas means something like knock-kneed. He obviously had something wrong with his knees. Anyway, Antigonus Gonatas didn't take too kindly to what the Athenians were doing to his father. And when the Galatians invaded Macedonia from the north in the 270s, Gonatas was able to defeat them and to use the chaos arising from their invasion and his recent military successes to seize the Macedonian throne. He ruled as Antigonus II, and he established the Antigonid dynasty, which is commonly dated as starting in 268. Now, the Antigonid dynasty would be the last great dynasty of Macedonia before the Romans brought it to an end in 146. Once Gonatas was secure in Macedonia, he quickly established his control over Greece. Now, although the Athenians, supported by Ptolemy II of Egypt, the one who actually did build the lighthouse, although they roused Greece to war against Gonatas in 268, what's called the Cremonidean War, Gonatas was well prepared. He quickly defeated the Greek states loyal to Athens, and in 262, he besieged Athens itself. It fell to him the following year in 261. Now, Gonatas couldn't afford to be lenient, and he established a string of garrisons in Athens, and he controlled both the assembly and elections to official offices. He ensured that only his supporters were elected to office, and that the assembly passed decrees on only his orders or those of his own men. So the democracy was a facade. This Cremonidean War, the one that had broken out in 268, helped by Ptolemy II, was really the last symbol of the Greeks trying to end the hegemony of Macedonia. That's the Greeks south of Mount Olympus, of course. Macedonia would now remain dominant until the Roman occupation. When Gonatas died in 239, his son, Demetrius II, succeeded his father, but no noises came from any of the Greeks. There were no revolts. There was no attempt to try to re-establish Greek independence. That's over. The Athenian position didn't really change with any of the subsequent Macedonian kings. And from about 200 BC, Athens was seen as still a centre of culture and learning, although the new centres of the Hellenistic world at Alexandria, Pergamum, and Antioch became the intellectual centres of the Hellenistic world. But although Athens was still seen as this centre of learning, it was no longer seen as a military power. The days of its military power had long been over. Now, the great kingdoms of Alexander's successors, especially Egypt and Syria, were the power bases of the Hellenistic period. But even they were unable to resist the steady imperialism of Rome. Roman involvement in the Greek East would lead to its annexation into the Roman Empire, thus explaining why the Greek world as a whole declined during the Hellenistic period. But as they say, that's another story. I'd like to turn now to consider the advances that the Greeks had made from the end of the Dark Ages to the Classical period and how these have affected our lives. As we know by now, at the end of the Dark Ages, the cities of Greece were oligarchies, controlled by a number of ruling families. They cared little for the ordinary people, the non-nobles, and they dispensed justice as arbitrarily as they ruled. Now, this pattern must have been something of a norm during the Dark Ages, or at least during the later Dark Ages. But the 8th century Renaissance brought with it not merely a rebirth of Greek civilization, which was marked by unprecedented novelty and achievement, but it brought with it the beginnings of a grassroots rebellion against the ruling families. This rebellion, which involved the lowest social stratum of society, as we might expect, as well as the middle stratum, the hoplites, would eventually lead to the creation of democracy and a legal code. And we know all about that now, don't we? Democracy and law were the two major achievements of the Archaic period. Now, these two topics alone justify the literal meaning of archaic that is given to the period. But as we know, there are many more new things happening in it. Just because the following period is labeled classical doesn't mean it's the most important in Greek history or the best. It's important because during the classical period, much of what began in the archaic period is developed and comes to maturity. But the downside to the achievements of the archaic period emerge in the classical. As cities developed economically and politically, they came more and more into conflict with each other. In many respects, you could argue, and I'm sure you're thinking along these lines already, that conflict was inevitable. The very nature of the polis system, with its emphasis on political self-sufficiency, gave rise to a feeling of independence and even xenophobia towards all others. That would eventually lead to armed clashes and warfare as Greek was pitted against Greek. We can see this even when Greece was faced by a common foe, such as the Persians in the early 5th century. They threatened to absorb Greece into the Persian Empire. But even in those dire times, not every Greek state united with the others, and disputes between Athens and Sparta over who is to lead the Greek forces against the Persians almost caused that fragile union of 31 states to dissolve. If the Athenians hadn't backed down and allowed the Spartans to take over, that union would probably have dissolved there and then, and the Persians would have won. Although there was warfare in the archaic period, of course, ending with the Persian Wars, as I've argued, it's in the classical period that we see a change in the nature of warfare and the development of imperialism on a grander and more ominous scale. The expansionist politics on the part of archaic era polis, think of the tyrants, for example, are the overture that reaches the crescendo in the classical, thanks to the larger and more powerful cities like Athens and Sparta that acquired empires and came to play a role in broader Greek affairs. Unable to reconcile hegemony of their empires with their allies' autonomy and the principles inherent in the polis system, they soon became exploitive and resented. In the case of Athens, thanks to the introduction of radical democracy by Ephialtes in 462, and the exploitation of different rhetorical styles, non-nobles, the demagogues, rose to power. Some pursued their own agendas. Others worked in the city's best interests. But all were imperialists. The apparent advantages of the polis system turned out to be fundamental weaknesses, contributing to the general disunity among the Greeks and a seemingly endless series of wars. They culminated in the greatest war of all time, so Thucydides would say, and that was the Peloponnesian War of 431 to 404, because of its scale, because of its duration, because of how it affected Greek society across the board. For Thucydides, the decline in morality was as much a disaster as any losses in battle. And another downside was the opportunity for the exploitation of the people that the warfare and the rise of democracy gave to the demagogues. No wonder Thucydides says of the constitution in 410, after the last vestiges of the 411 oligarchy had disappeared, that in his opinion it was the best, because this new constitution was a moderate blending of the few and the many. It was not the same direct democracy. Of course, like the phoenix, radical democracy would soon rise again. But imperialistic designs ended when Greece as a whole clashed with Macedonia under Philip II and fell under Macedonian hegemony. And in 322, the Macedonians abolished the direct democracy of Athens, and it never recovered. This brings me to my final set of considerations in this lecture on whether we've made similar developments in our society as the Greeks did, and how much have we really learned or not learned from the Greeks? Now, like the Greeks, we've had to adapt to meet different societies' needs, which is as much a development as anything the Greeks did. For example, think of how in the classical Athenian democracy, women were citizens, but they didn't have the right to vote or represent themselves in court. Yet as we discussed in Lecture 33, women ran the oikos, and oikoi were needed for a polis to exist. So women played as important a role in the polis as arguably the men did. But the ancient Greeks' belief that women did not need political rights is carried over in the centuries that follow. It took the suffragette movement in 19th century Britain to get people to consider giving women the vote. Now, this was not a rebellion against ancient Greece, of course, and I doubt whether Mrs. Pankhurst was thinking of Lysistrata's statement that women could run a polis like they ran the oikos as she chained herself to those railings. But it's a sign that, like the Greeks, we recognize developments and need to change to meet them. And even then, women only got the right to vote in America in 1920, I believe. In some cases, societies made the sorts of changes that we saw in the archaic period, especially to fix things that had changed for the worse. The Greeks left us their democratic and legal systems. But in many countries, these faded with time. Think of the despotic power of kings and the socio-economic plight of non-nobles in medieval and early modern Europe. For example, King John of England. He ruled from 1199 to 1216 AD. John ignored the sufferings and grievances of the ordinary people, and the disastrous loss to the French at Bouvines in Flanders in 1214 brought England to its knees. The English barons revolted, and they forced John to sign a document, the Magna Carta, in 1215. This agreement set limits on the autocratic power of the kings, for the barons now had a legal say in state matters, rather than being consulted only when the king decided. Magna Carta was a further step forward in the rise of the English parliamentary system. It also recognized non-nobles as free men who had legal rights, and it eventually led to trial by jury in the 14th century. What does all this remind you of? Harsh, exploitive and unsympathetic rulers, civil distress in the states of these rulers, and even military losses. The forcing of said rulers to agree to terms that bring equality, legal rights, and involvement in political affairs. Back we go to archaic Athens. I'm sure you can think of many more examples throughout history and down to today. But how much have we really learned from the Greeks, or not learned from them, and should we have learned more? On the surface, it looks like we've learned a lot, and we certainly owe them a lot. I think history has shown not just the value of democracy and a legal system to protect the rights of individuals and to ensure equality before the laws, isonomia, but the need for these. Societies eventually find their way back to these things if they've fallen into disuse, or they want them when they see how they benefit everyone. The Greeks in the Hellenistic period got used to being part of a world far larger than their own. And then countries throughout history felt the same thing. We know today that our country doesn't exist in isolation, and in doing so, we're probably sharing the same feelings as those Greeks did, as they got used to being part of a larger whole. When the mainland Greeks in the later 4th century fell under the Macedonian hegemony, they lost their autonomy and their freedom, which were ideals inherent in the polis system. It's these ideals that caused states to go to war with each other, then and now, and which were praised in funeral orations from classical times to modern, from Pericles to Lincoln to Clinton, as we've discussed in previous lectures. By looking at Greek history, we can appreciate all the more the importance of freedom and democracy. What we haven't done is properly learn from the Greeks about the downfalls of imperialism. We're still overly influenced by the rhetoric of political leaders, which can be disastrous. Politics doesn't change much over the centuries, nor does the exploitation of rhetoric. And even today, an effective speaker is likely to win far more votes, regardless of the policies he or she puts forward. It's not as though no one studies history. People know what happened in the past, good or bad. So why haven't we learned more? Thucydides tells us why in his account of the Peloponnesian War. Thucydides wrote that he hoped his work would be appreciated by those, and I quote now, who want to understand clearly the events which happened in the past and which, human nature being what it is, will at some time or another, and in much the same way, be repeated in the future. He goes on to say, my work is not a piece of writing designed to meet the taste of an immediate public, but was done to last forever. Well, we can see that modesty isn't one of Thucydides' virtues. But more importantly, what Thucydides is getting at is that he wants posterity to see not just what went wrong and caused the catastrophic Peloponnesian War that tore Greece apart. Thucydides is not idealistic or naive as to think that posterity will learn from the lessons of the Greeks and not repeat the same mistakes. What he's telling us is that it doesn't matter how bad something is, human nature won't allow us to learn properly from it, and human nature will let it happen again. We've taken so much from Greek civilization and we've learned so much from it. But in the end, one of its most important aspects is something we cannot take. And that's our fault. Shame on us. But the Greeks too didn't learn from their mistakes. Look at Athens in the 5th century and then in the 4th. What might have happened to Philip II if even 31 Greek states had managed to band together and unite against him from the outset, as they did against Xerxes in 481? Perhaps there's less separating us from the ancient Greeks than we might think, or rather, than we are told there is. Well, thank you very much again for choosing this course. I hope you enjoyed it. And for now, goodbye, ladies and gentlemen.
We hope you have enjoyed these lectures from our Great Courses series. Our courses are now available to order online. Visit our website at www.teach12.com or call our customer care representatives at 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-TEACH-12. Thank you very much.